Good morning. The Hobby Lobby decision continues to fuel speculation that its discrimination safeguards won't be enough. Today we'll talk with law professor Andrea Freeman. The potential for irrevocable outcomes is also the fear of several local conservation groups. They're concerned about the plan to develop Kauainui Marsh. Audubon Society President Linda Pohl makes her case. It's The Conversation for Wednesday, July 2nd on HBR2.
And if you hate the hiccups, this might change your mind. Get ready, because here comes the Hiccup Circus. It's a summer of workshop fun with an environmental message. And we'll talk with Mark Jeffers of Kauai Storybook Theater. It's the season to honor ancestors at Obon events, and Gerald Hirata of the Kauai Soto Zen Temple takes us inside an ancient tradition.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop.
The conversation starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We're just starting to feel the after effects of this Supreme Court decision, aren't we?
We are, and the way in which they're layered over some of the decisions that we've seen over the last couple of years is what a lot of people find troubling. We're going to talk a little bit about the decision this morning, and let's get going with that first conversation now. At the heart of the Hobby Lobby decision was the question of what counts more, a company's closely held religious belief or its legal responsibility to provide contraception. This week, the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision sided in favor of the company's right to choose. The decision has spawned more questions about corporate personhood and the potential for discrimination. UH Law Professor Andrea Freeman joins us now to look at some of the implications. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, a lot of people are very concerned that this is going to change the game in a way that, you know, maybe this is the tipping point where religion becomes the driver, not necessarily legal responsibility for a great many things. And, you know, Ginsburg, you know, was blasting the, you know, those in the majority. And of course, you know, they blasted right back saying that, you know, she was being wildly speculative. But her point that they can, quote, opt out of any law saving tax laws they judge incompatible with their sincerely held religious beliefs seems to be where we're now stuck. How do you view this decision?
I think it is a frightening decision that does open up the door for corporations to be perceived as people that can establish a religion in this country, which is against the First Amendment principle that the government is not supposed to favor one religion over another. Here we saw a favoring of Christian values, but if this had been a Muslim company that was attempting to practice their religion, I think we might have seen a different decision.
As you look at it in the context of what may happen with future decisions and other things that are still brewing, part of the concern is now this may be a way for businesses to pick and choose, not necessarily because they really truly hold these close religious values, but that they may be able to use that to simply make choices and discriminate how they do business.
Absolutely. You may have heard that the retirement funds of Hobby Lobby and some of these companies actually donate money to the exact products that they are objecting to here. So there is a question among the public, not in the court, but in the public, as to whether this was a sincerely held religious belief. But the court decided not to question that. And that's another dangerous precedent. Because as you're saying, anything, a corporation could just say, we believe this, and if the court is not going to question that, then we may see more discrimination against lesbian and gay couples, the denial of hormone medication for transgendered people, and a whole range of possible discrimination that's opened up by the decision.
Looking at how the decision itself was made and looking at who said what, some of it was predictable, perhaps, but looking at those swing judges, are we really having to look at the Supreme Court a little bit differently?
I think there was a hope or an idea that this was a narrow decision and that perhaps we saw some of the justices going with it because of that. But I do think that we are seeing a very definite conservative voice emerging on the court that may bode not too well for future decisions that people are really hanging on. For example, DOMA, gay marriage, if that's going to be.
Again, taken up.
Yeah.
What's your biggest fear as you look into this decision and look at it going into the future and other potential cases that are brewing?
My biggest fear is around discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals, because I think that we may see the court has given a little bit on marriage, the ideas of marriage and DOMA, but they haven't given where it's really important, right? We have Shelby County. We have, disregard for racial discrimination in the country, and I think that where it counts, the court's going to uphold discrimination, whereas they've given a kind of small bone to people.
Well, DOMA seems like it was a rather big bone for a lot of people, that it wasn't just as insubstantial as I think you may be suggesting.
I'm not saying that it's insubstantial, but the entire gay marriage issue is often seen as a cover, as something that is a privilege for many people, but doesn't get at really serious suffering by, LGBT individuals in prisons, in the workplace, in homes, violence, abuse, that those are the real issues facing people, and that, the marriage and benefits is kind of more of a privilege issue that's not as hard to give up.
So that some of the more practical and daily aspects of life, that's what I'm hearing you say, mm-hmm. is where you see this being far more problematic than necessarily the coverall of saying, well, yes, this is something that we think is all right, but when it comes down to very narrow, very specific things, you find that that's going to be much more problematic for us as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. If you're like us and you want to get married, you're like the straight people and we just want to get married and hold, you want to keep our values, that's okay, right? But then when it comes to issues of violence, abuse, housing discrimination, employment discrimination, we're still going to uphold that in the name of religious belief.
In terms of the actual case itself and some of the conversation that swirling around the country about the parts that the Hobby Lobby group really found objectionable was the issue of abortifacients. But your position has been on this, that the science is a bit skewed the other way, and it was a case of who wanted to listen to what science and whether these things actually abortifacients or not.
Right. I mean, there is no science saying that they are. That's just a belief. So if a corporation can have a belief that goes against the FDA and goes against the proven science and have the court back it up, that's frightening.
Because they didn't object to everything, but they were objecting to some.
They selected
specific.
The four methods,
right.
But the FDA has stated, backed by scientific and medical research, that in fact eggs are not fertilized at that point and that they're simply wrong.
Which brings us back to the beginning of the conversation where you have belief against belief and not necessarily fact against fact. Is this a fundamental change for the way we are going to look at our court system and also how we regard our government?
It's early to say what will happen after this, but it's certainly a danger.
All right. Well, you're going to be watching it. We'll talk to you more. We've got to go for the moment.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Andrea Freeman is a constitutional law professor at the William S. Richardson School of Law. She also teaches federal courts and race and law. She researches and writes in the areas of structural inequality and food policy, as well as consumer credit card debt.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Later in the show, the Hiccup Circus imagines an environmentally friendly ecotopia. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaiti.
Later this hour, we'll be talking about Hawaii's obon tradition, and that got us thinking about the history of one of Hawaii's Japanese media. Colorful obon events will be held throughout the islands this summer, and you might just find yourself consulting the 2014 Bondan schedule put out by the Hawaii Herald. The Herald is Hawaii's Japanese American journal, and its history goes back more than a century. It was established in 1912 by Fred Kenzaburo Makino to serve Hawaii's Japanese community. He came to Hawaii from Yokohama in 1899 when he was 21, the son of an English merchant trader, and Ken Makino, a native of Japan's Kanagawa Prefecture. He worked on a Big Island sugar plantation before moving to Oahu, and that's when he opened Makino Drugstore in Nu'uanu. He also worked to help other Japanese immigrants, and his commitment led him to found a newspaper to represent the voice of the community. The paper began its life under a different name than it's known now, and that's what we're looking for in this morning's Backyard Quiz. Can you tell us the original name for the Hawaii Herald? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll be back with the answer in the next half hour.
Aloha, I'm Sherry Broder from the John Van Dyke Institute of International Law and Justice. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
You don't have to run away to join the circus these days, at least not if you're on Kauai during the next week or so. That's when Kauai's Storybook Theater will play host to the Big Island's Hiccup Circus, which is coming to the Garden Isle to share its skills and to put on a show called Ecotopia, an event that promotes an environmental message with juggling pins made from recycled plastic bottles, while jugglers walk on stilts made from recycled wood. There's a lot more going on here than circus stunts, and Mark Jeffers of Storybook Theater is in Ihanepepe on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chris.
Captain Mark, I should say.
Well, Captain Mark in another context, but yes, I'm the executive director here at Storybook Theater. Happy to be aboard.
And you folks use the whole thing of circus events and circus performance to tell a story, get a message out, yeah?
Well, Storybook Theater is the producer of this particular event, mm-hmm. Chris. This is a group of people that are a very famous, actually, group of people from the Big Island. Mm-hmm. And they are my old acquaintances from many years ago. People may remember Graham Ellis of Volcano Circus. They have a beautiful property down by Kalapana, and he trains young people to go out into the community to show off their circus arts, and the young people are called Hiccup Circus. Those are the folks we're bringing here to Kauai.
But when the Hiccup Circus performs, it performs with a message.
Well, the message always in circus arts is fun, excitement, energy, timing, skill. You know, how do they do that? You know, that's kind of always the medium is the message. Beyond that, subtly, there's the ecotopia concept because we're performing with young people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, recycling is a trendy thing now in schools. Everybody's got a small garden and is bringing their newspapers and soda cans to their classrooms in the morning. And, you know, it's an exciting thing. So, okay, what's the next step? Well, make that into something. Reuse it.
As you actually reuse the materials used in the performance, yeah?
Yeah, the guys, of course, you're down there in Pune, you know, that's kind of far out into the provinces, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, but you have to have things to make and create into juggling or the circus arts props, the props that go with circus arts, things like costumes.
Right.
So, you know, thrift shops are always on the top of the line list for the Hiccup Boys. And also, believe it or not, hotel tennis courts, because those used tennis balls are, well, with a little bit of work on them, are excellent for juggling props.
Yeah, and tennis players tend to discard those balls in large numbers, as I well know.
Well, these guys, they slice them open, they put coins in them,
uh-huh,
giving them a little weight and a little jingle, and then they put a balloon around it, and then they tape it up with electrician tape.
Wow.
And that becomes a very tight little unit for juggling.
Huh.
And, of course, we have to go in search of those tennis balls here on Kauai. And the boys are going to come over for a week. They're going to stay here at Storybook Theater, which is a performing art theater for children here in Hanapepe on the west side of the island.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to stay in our classroom, sleeping on the floor, and they're going to go out every day, courtesy of the mayor's summer enrichment program, and we're going to go out and visit different sites, and we're going to do lecture demonstrations, and we have some public performing too, so the whole island can come out and see these guys.
Well, Mark, when kids are first exposed to the circus arts, and they say they want to learn juggling and stilt walking, how difficult is that to learn?
Well, juggling itself would take about a week of, you know, a couple hours a day of work. You have to sort of reprogram your nervous system. Children are young enough so that they don't have a lot of programming in there. So when they stand up and work on a juggling move, you know, with one ball, two balls, three balls or more,
mm-hmm,
then they're in the act of programming or setting their nerves and muscles right there and then. And if the coaching is right, you know, with lots of appreciation, but sort of tough love, then they get it. And when you start to get it, like stilt walking as well, when you start to pick up that feeling of balance, it's very exciting. It's very, it's an immediate reinforcement. And
is
that's
it easier
rare now in education, just the immediacy of a physical reinforcement like that.
Is it easier when you're young?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. There's no doubt about that. I have attempted to learn to juggle several times. Of course, my juggling, and I'm sure yours is as well, Chris, is your the mental juggling that we do to just balance our day with our to-do list, you know, what we want to try to accomplish. That's a form of juggling as well. But children, they learn best with experiential opportunities. So this is a great experience for them to be able to step up to this plate.
And it sounds as if motor skills are easier to learn when you're less programmed. That's kind of what you're saying, huh?
Well, motor skills are, you know, they're part of a child's whole day. The whole day is spent, you know, in exploration. The best kinds of learning that children can do is like something right in front of them. And that's why I love outdoor classrooms the best, where you can, you know, you're involved in exploring right away, and there's a real fresh kind of a great feeling in that. But children learn by experience, so and if they're willing to take the challenge, now that sometimes is a problem, sometimes with intermediate school age, 10, 11, 12, 13, right in there, just standing up in front of the crowd or being the first one to step up or trying something and then not doing it exactly right and being embarrassed, you know, those kinds of things get in the way. Probably the best age to learn something like this is, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, right in that time frame.
Well, Mark, it's interesting that you pinpoint that to a specific age, because it does seem at that just pre-adolescent years is sort of the dawn of self-consciousness, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's the way I see it.
It sounds as if you've learned a lot about learning in the course of presenting.
Well, I'm an educator. I was trained at the University of Hawaii as a teacher trainer, actually, and I taught in community colleges, early education. My focus has been preschool age children. So child development is something that you have to really immerse yourself in and really know the basics of. And you have to know that all children develop the same, going through the same recognizable stages of development in not only physical development, but emotional and cognitive as well. And when you can recognize those stages, then you can provide learning opportunities that challenge the child just right. Not too much, not too less, but just right challenge, you know. And I think that's what teachers need to be involved with, is knowing as much as they can about child development so that they can provide those opportunities in their classroom.
So it sounds as if those developmental categories that have been used in education, they're pretty accurate in your observation.
Well, it's true for human beings all over the world. I mean, you know, the human as a species goes through these same stages of development. So, you know, it's something that we all have in common. We could share more with, you know, other nations what we know and let them teach us what they know.
That'd
language
be nice.
Is the critical part, of course, because language is sort of a reflection of what you know inside and what you're capable of.
Well, Mark, it's good to talk to you about this. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking
sure.
the time.
Not a problem. Can I toot the horn for our public performance?
We'll do that. Mark Jeffers is the executive director of the Storybook Theater in Hanapepe, Kauai, which is presenting shows and workshops in the coming week from the Hiccup Circus. There are performances Friday and Saturday, July 11th and 12th, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
America is America, except how we divide ourselves up determines our politics and how we allocate resources in virtually everything we do. In the past 5 years, America has been on the move and absorbing influxes of all kinds. What does that mean for election 2014 or even 16? The red-blue mix of America's electoral pie. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More and more station members are choosing sustaining membership as their preferred method of support. Thank you to Christopher and Maria Lutz of Honolulu, Cecilia Romero of Kahului, and Vincent Linares of Kula for helping HPR to plan for the future. Sustaining membership is an easy installment program of $5 or more per month, and it continues until you say otherwise. To find out more, contact the membership department at 955-8821, or you can visit the support page at hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Joy of Sake, a sake celebration featuring more than 370 sakes to taste and sake-friendly appetizers from 19 restaurants, July 18th at the Hawaii Convention Center, joyofsake.com.
The first of the five scheduled debates in the race for Hawaii's Senate seat is now over. What seemed to emerge is that there may be style and demeanor that pull votes for each candidate. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair was there and has this reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and good morning to all the people on Kauai. I love your island.
We were just there. We can heartily agree. But then again, we say that about whenever we travel throughout Hawaii and
Absolutely.
Take a show there. But speaking about the debate last night, I mean, debate is sort of a tough word to use because there were many things on which both candidates agreed.
Quite a lot. And I could just go through the list. I'll just name a couple: Native Hawaiian self-determination, the importance to deal with climate change, the need to develop renewable energy. There were so many things that they agreed on. There were a few differences here and there, but in many ways, I think a lot of folks may look at these two candidates and base their vote on their persona, how they behave, their history, their experiences, rather than their positions. Because there's not really a whole lot of big differences between, at least policy-wise, between Colleen Hanabusa and Brian Schatz, with a few exceptions.
Which means to say that maybe the likability factor or the sense of style that each imbues into how they behave is more what may pull votes one way or the other.
It could be. I mean, there was a lot of folks there last night. They filled the room at the War Memorial Conference Convention Hall. And they clearly were there because they care about the issues. I think a lot of folks wanted to see where they stood on GMO and on veterans and Iraq and a whole lot of other issues. But there is something about a candidate's personality. Hanabusa prides herself on knowing the arcane, the depth of the policy issues. Schatz came off as more personal, making an issue, how does an issue relate to someone's family? And I noticed those two differences last night.
As we see that now there are going to be four more,
yes,
these kinds of issues I think are going to probably be resurfacing in some way. Is there anything that the candidates are moving toward that you can see will be emerging in larger conversations that might pull those people who are still as yet undecided?
I wonder if Iraq might make a difference. Hanabusa has been very outspoken in recent weeks through her advertising, through her office, saying, what are we doing in Iraq again? Why should we send troops there? Very concerned about that. Schatz expressed much the same sentiment last night. He has not said as much publicly as Hanabusa, but you wonder if that might be an issue. The Veterans Administration issue surfaced last night as well, and Hanabusa and Schatz differed over in terms of where resources should go to help facilities. Hanabusa was focused on Guam. Schatz was focused here on Hawaii. So those issues, I think GMO is another issue, particularly as they go to the neighbor islands again. They'll be in Hilo tonight, and GMO is an issue that came up last night.
As we go forward, then, and it's not going to be necessarily just the nuances of these issues, but maybe one or two that might galvanize people and lead them in different directions.
I think so. A lot of people, in many ways, there's one issue that's more important than anything else, and sometimes they vote for a candidate simply because, well, I like what he or she said on that particular issue. That's the person I'm going to vote for.
It may come down to that. Okay. For the moment, we'll leave it there. We've got a lot more to talk about as we see several more debates, including one that you're sponsoring. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for the plug.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:31. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Stay tuned to hear how a long-standing old country tradition has become a part of Ireland life. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Sabah al-Khair. I am Hakim Belabbes. I'm a Chicago Moroccan filmmaker. And you're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line, and Bert, these geolocators are really opening up a lot of possibilities, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and it's something called proximity services. It's based on a technology called Bluetooth Low Energy, and I've been seeing them kind of pop up here and there, and what we've done is we've invited a couple of companies that are doing local app development here and have incorporated this concept of the Bluetooth Low Energy into their application. Now, people might be kind of familiar with Apple's version of it. It's called iBeacon. And it's been out for a little while, but I think what's happening is that the technology is becoming more affordable and then the applications are being built. But part of the ecosystem requires the, let's say, retailer to start incorporating, you know, these systems. And the
what does it do, Bert?
The beacon. It's a really tiny little device.
Yeah.
And what you do is it basically talks to you if you're in, let's say, a proximity of less than 100 meters of that iBeacon device. It'll talk to your smartphone, and it'll tell you that there might be a special going on in this store, or there might be a discount going on, or there's something interesting like an event that's happening, you know, in town as you kind of go by.
So a message will pop up as I'm moving around. I might have this thing pop up and say, hey, stop in here, it's 20% off,
yeah,
that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, our smartphones are becoming such an integral part of our life that, you know, we look at it all the time, looking at notifications, whether there's email coming in or maybe somebody's giving you a SMS text chat or something. And now with these beacons, they can now send you a notification of something that is happening at perhaps a retail outlet or maybe something that's interesting going on around town.
So that's what all those people are looking at, Bert.
Well, they're, you know, that'll be the day. I mean, it'll. I think it's definitely a growing market opportunity.
Terrific. Well, thanks a lot, Bert. That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
Now, from discount shopping that may pop up on your phone to a little more natural location. Now, it might sound like an idyllic setting for campers, cultural practitioners, and people who just want to be out in nature, but with amenities. The state's plan to develop Kauainui Marsh with buildings, roads, campsites, and all sorts of other things would substantially change the character of the wetland. Some organizations have called that plan a land grab. Linda Paul is president of the Audubon Society, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
With all of the, you know, that term, a land grab, putting that aside for a second, just looking at what is in the plan itself, it seems that many of the elements might very well be characterized as thwarting each other. Would you agree with that?
I would definitely agree with that. We have several buildings planned that are mauka of a wetland, and this is a wetland, a marsh of international importance, a Ramsar site, and it is an inappropriate area for all of many, many, many of the activities that have been put in this plan. Restoration of waterbird habitat, which is one of our chief concerns, is taking place in a 90-acre, roughly, area. But that area was purchased with land and water conservation funds, which also has a recreational component. The marsh itself is almost 900 acres large, and there is a lot of area in there that needs to be restored. It needs to have public access close to it. If you look at places like Campbell National Wildlife Refuge, whole months out of the year, no public is allowed to go in there because it's nesting season. It disturbs the birds. So it is incompatible to have trails and buildings and all of this going on in an area that's being restored for waterbird habitat, for endangered species benefit.
What about some of the other elements of being able to have, you know, restoration of ponds?
The pond restoration project was something that we have sponsored. We, in fact, have adopted one of the ponds. Our members work there once a month clearing out alien species. But that, again, is in an area where they have projected to have a maintenance road cut across that area in between the ponds to maintain another area that they are restoring. That area just below Les Jardins Academy is also an excellent area to do stream restoration and native habitat. But you have that whole area surrounded by a maintenance yard for the Department of Land and Natural Resources, which needs to be removed to the transfer station. You have this causeway and roadway cutting across it. You have roads on three sides of it. You have trails on three sides of it. It's just the two are working against one another.
Isn't the point of ponds to be able to have a flow-through system? How can you have a flow-through system if you have roads cutting across it and maintenance works being done around it?
Yes, the ponds themselves are high-tech ponds. They have to have water pumped up to them. They were built deliberately above the water level of the marsh because there are old walls from ancient loess underneath.
So there's no natural flow through?
There's no natural flow through, and there's no way for the water to get out, actually. So there are sections, at least on the downstream side of the pond that we adopted, that are actually turning anoxic. They smell like rotten eggs. We're all familiar with that smell.
So what happens when you have a pond in that state, also in a wetland?
For the water birds, it is a serious threat because...
I mean, it sounds like it's a sort of a bit of a toxic mess.
Yes, and you can actually have a threat outbreak of botulism in a situation like that, and these endangered species will die. It's not, I mean, it was well-intentioned, but they're trying to accommodate too much, save the walls, but save the birds at the same time, and you're ending up with something that's not doing what it needed to have done.
Okay, so your points so far that you have buildings and maintenance roads and all kinds of other things that are in a place where they shouldn't be, although some of this land was purchased with funds that would necessitate recreation. That seems to be an inherent conflict at its very base. But now what do you do when you have all of these things that are planned for it and buildings that independent organizations are going to have to raise funds to be able to make happen if, in fact, it does go forward? Was the community okay with this happening as this way?
No, the community, there were several community meetings, lots of them. There was community input. I attended most of them. The community that I saw trying to fill out these forms, they were given choices of where do you want to put these facilities. There wasn't the option on the table of do you really want to have them or not, but people wrote that option in. Kailua Neighborhood Board has kept a very careful tally of community input and has concluded that what is in the plan is not what the community input reflected. Audubon Society is not opposed to cultural centers or education centers. They just need to be on the Mackay side of the marsh, on the downstream side. Gateway Park, for example, on Kawainui Canal, the Wailua Corner, the old ITT Center at the gate to Kailua Town, because there's a sewer system there. Ulupo is not exactly downstream, but it's in an area where there are a lot of housing and there's sewage there. The area below Kalaheo High School, again, is an area that's not exactly in the wetland. It's on the uphill side of the channel there, and you could put a cultural center there. But anything mauka of that, we should not be putting buildings, roads, trails, parking lots, anything of that sort. It's a wetland. That's what it is. It's not an appropriate place to have these kinds of things.
As you mentioned earlier that it's a Ramsar-designated site, is there anything within that designation that would automatically say that this can't happen, that it can't be developed?
Well, what is interesting, I mean, there are basically four criteria that this wetland met in order to be declared a wetland, world wetland of international importance. The fact that there are endangered birds there, the fact that it's a rare and unique wetland type, that it's a migratory path for native gobies, that there's ecological diversity there. That's another reason why that big, huge mat of vegetation in the middle of the pond that the public sees trees growing out of, that's all alien species. They say it provides flood control and protection for Kawainui Town, but there needs to be a hydrology study done. That mat is taking up water storage space.
But going back to the point that you just made, for those reasons that you've listed, is there any grounds on which you could stand to say you just can't do this with this wetland because of its international importance?
I think there is a danger we could lose it, and it would be very embarrassing for this state because the International Union of Concerned Scientists of IUCN is actually meeting here in 2016, and IUCN is the one that sponsored the Ramsar Convention.
Which was in 1971.
So,
I mean, a very long time and long designation.
That's right. They're going to visit this
site. So how do you see the conversation moving forward so that, different elements and different entities aren't alienating each other as much as this plan seems to be thwarting itself with different elements that don't work in concert?
I think it needs to go back to the drawing board. I think it needs to be done better. it needs, the concepts need to be fleshed out about how we're going to work with the whole marsh and not just certain parts of it, a few buildings along the edge, the one center, 190 acres that's being restored. And we need to look at the whole marsh and if and plan for the future 20, 40, 50 years down the line.
From a holistic perspective.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much. We're going to leave it there for the moment. Linda Paul is the president of the Hawaii Audubon Society. Thanks.
Thank you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we looked at the beginnings of the Hawaii Herald, Hawaii's Japanese-American journal. It has been around for more than a century, though not always with the same name. Its founder, Fred Kinzaburo Makino, was a tireless advocate of the interests of Japanese-American workers. The Hawaii Herald began publication on December 7, 1912, to give those workers a voice. Through his editorials, Makino helped Japanese soldiers who fought for the United States in World War I win U.S. citizenship. He also defended Japanese language schools from discriminatory rules and regulations. The paper underwent a name change when the Pearl Harbor attack and the Second World War cast all things Japanese in a suspicious light, although the paper continued to serve as a voice of the community. For today's quiz, we asked you for the paper's original name. The Hawaii Herald Company continues today as a full-service printing facility, but once the newspaper was Hawaii Hochi. It's 848, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Obon, the Japanese tradition that goes back more than 500 years in its homeland, has taken on new life in Hawaii, where it has become a celebration of family life that is shared by all generations. It's Obon season in the islands, and you'll see a variety of cultures represented in a dance of celebration that Hawaii has in many ways made its own. Most of us know about the Bon Odori, or Bon Dance, but that's only part of the story. It's a world Gerald Hirata, president of the Kauai Soto Zen Temple in Hanapepe, knows well, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Gerald. How are you?
Good morning. Aloha and greetings from the Garden Island.
You know, I get the feeling that you're kind of the person to talk to about this, Gerald. It's...
Well, because I've been at the temple now. I've returned to the temple, actually, of my youth for the last 7 years. And then this is, like most Buddhist temples, this is our largest event of the year, and it's a good fundraiser. So we put effort into this festival, which is coming up in about 2 weeks, a week from now.
Well, Gerald, what are your memories of Obon events when you were a kid, when you first were experiencing them?
Well, when I was growing up, it was in a plantation community. This is where the Buddhist temple was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more cultural. During this time of the year, June, July, and August, our grandparents insisted, my grandfather insisted that we make gravesite visitations because Obon is a time when you honor the spirits, your ancestors, your loved ones who have departed.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go to the gravesites and make offerings and pray, and an essential part of it is welcoming the spirits of your ancestors. So we would offer food as well, and we could do this in the family altars at home. So this is a time when the living, and I would say those who have passed on, can be together once again.
That's kind of, there's a real beauty in that when you see it, especially when you go to an event. You can really feel it in the air, can't you?
I think so, and it's a universal spirit. So there are many members of different communities that come and participate, and it's a lively, joyous time, and it's very festive. And people do get caught up in the dancing, and that's one of the primary focus, I think, and most visible part of the Bowen Festival. But there are other components as well, you know, like food and game booths and just a time for families and where you could meet with your friends and socialize.
I ran across the story of how it all originated. Mm-hmm. Gerald, would you tell me that story? I love that.
Sure. This goes back, way back, I guess, even as far back as India. But the story goes that there was a disciple of the Buddha who could peek into the supernatural world. So in Buddhist cosmology, he discovered that his mom, who had passed, was suffering in this never-never land, this realm of the hungry ghosts. So she could never, she was always hungry and always thirsty. Mm. So when he saw his mother suffering, the disciple went to the Buddha to ask for advice. And then the Buddha told him that on the 15th day of the seventh month, you should offer food to the monks who were just about to end their retreat. And then his mom would then be released from suffering. And when he did that, he was so happy that his mom was released that he literally danced with joy. And that's how we get the Bowen Odori.
Well, you can, you know, even knowing nothing about that story, Gerald, mm-hmm. when you first, I remember the first time I saw one of a Bowen dance, you could absolutely feel that spirit in the air.
Mm-hmm. It's a lively music, and there are lanterns, and the idea about these lanterns, it lights the way so the spirits can return. And I remember when my dad passed in 2007, I was looking forward to the next Bowen season because this is when I could be with my dad again. So what I did at that time was I went to the temples when they were, well, our temple, when we were doing Bowen dance practicing. So I made sure that I knew all of the dances so I could be in the ring with my dad at that time.
And there are several dances to learn. Do they each have a kind of a specific message to them?
There's a repertoire of dances. You know, we at our festival do about 16 of them, but we also have live performances. And then on different islands, we do things slightly differently, but we do emphasize live performances. And here on Kauai, and I know at our temple, we do 3 live dances with taiko drums and singing.
What's the role of the drum in all this?
Well, basically, it's just to give. It's fairly recent, actually. You know, taiko has been around maybe since the late 70s or early 80s, but it's become an integral part, I think, of a lot of Japanese festivals. And then on Kauai, what we do is we provide just that background beat. Although we do have taiko performances, but while the Bowen dancing is going on with recorded music, we just provide taiko drums to give that rhythm and the beat.
You know, I'm surprised to learn that it's a recent addition because it seems such an integral part of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should take that back, but the taiko drum has always been part of the Bowen tradition because prior to recorded music, the only instrument that was available was a drum. So you would have the drum and the live singing and little else. You know, and this would go back maybe to the early 1900s. But then after recorded music would come in, you could provide all of that, the music and, you know, the rhythm.
You know, what's interesting to me, Gerald, is that although the ancestors have gone on, their remembrance is a joyous event, yeah?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the Bowen tradition. It could be stemming from Buddhist culture, but it's also part, I think, of the cultural, religious folk culture that I like to sort of define it. And here in Hawaii, you know, it's a folk culture that has evolved, especially the Japanese-American community, for over 5 to 6 generations.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to witness. Thanks very much for talking with us, Gerald.
Yes, thank you. And I would like to invite anyone who's on the island.
We'll send them
time.
Your way, Gerald. Gerald Hirata is president of the Kauai Soto Zen Temple in Hanapepe, Kauai, which is inviting the public to an Obon celebration Friday and Saturday, June 11th and 12th. And you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Kuana Torres Kahele performs from his Music for the Hawaiian Islands series on Saturday, July 5th. HBR's Atherton Studio gives you an up-close and personal experience of this award-winning composer and vocalist. Reserve your seats now and get a sneak peek of his soon-to-be-released CD featuring songs of Ni'ihau. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org.
Beth Ann, Obon is a commemoration of those who have gone on, of one's ancestors, but there's nothing grim about it. It's a very celebratory event, and you can really feel that in the air when you go to one of these.
There's a great deal of fun in it.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, Gerald was telling me that it's something that Hawaii has very much made its own, and that the younger generation in Hawaii is perhaps more attuned to these even than what he observes from that generation in Japan.
Interesting if there would be some conversation to have a little compare and contrast of how Obon runs in Japan versus what we see here in Hawaii. Yeah.
Very much been kept alive here, though. It's kind of nice to see.
We've got lots more to see and talk about, starting with tomorrow. Now, you may remember that earlier in the spring, we talked about the Big Island's GVS Transmedia Accelerator. Well, we're going to get an update about the few who made it through and what that means for Hawaii.
And Shakuhachi Master Riley Lee will perform live in our studio.
Ooh, that's going to be good. Meanwhile, if you've got a conversation the rest of us should hear, there are lots of ways for you to be in touch. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or me at BKOZHPR. Email works too. That's talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can hear today's show again at hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation.